Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. I can't tell online. Where I'm looking, I have a strange aspect ratio today because I copied some slides from some other file that somehow has screwed up things, but hopefully it'll be legible. At any rate, just a reminder that you have exam one coming up in 2 weeks, and we'll talk more about that as we get a little closer. No lecture meetings next week, because I have to travel for research. I will post slides and audio. They'll appear on the class website next week. I will certainly try to get them up before the actual lecture would take place for you. But that is contingent a little bit on sometimes even network connections where I am. But I will try to get that up, certainly before lecture. I'll try to do it well in advance, but I don't know whether I'll manage to do that or not. Sort of along the same lines, I'm traveling a long way, so I'll be out of touch literally for about 36 hours and just in preps and recovery time. I sort of guess that my email answers will be delayed over this weekend and over next weekend, so I'll try to catch up during the week. Okay. Any questions about any of that? Okay. So last time we looked at multidimensional motion, or often it's called projectile motion. And projectile motion, you can sort of think of it as being in two dimensions, but basically you can do this kind of stuff in four dimensions. And so as a function of time, you can track an object, and you can characterize its position using a vector given a coordinate system. It will also potentially have it will have a velocity even if it's zero. Okay, and it will have an acceleration. And these things are related in that the derivative of the position gives you the velocity, the derivative of the velocity gives you acceleration. But really you could have whatever going on at a given time. So if you really want to describe the position of something, which may sound sort of boring, but in the end it's the essence of a whole lot of what you do in science. Then you want to know all three of these things as a function of time. And so a big chunk of the start of this course is really to figure out how one does that in different physical situations. So one of the important things, which I hope you already know, is that these multiple dimensions really act independently. So the way that you do this kind of problem is you can take complicated multidimensional motion. So here's a classic projectile moving near the surface of the Earth. Because it's moving near the surface of the Earth, there's only one force on it if we ignore air resistance, and that is the force of gravitation down, and it is a constant value, assuming that this isn't an enormously large projectile height, right? So you have a constant acceleration downward at all time. We have it starting with an initial velocity, which has an upward component and a sideways component. The acceleration is zero in this dimension, so this velocity never changes, so it just keeps going. The upward component of the velocity changes because you have a non-zero acceleration going down. So as you go up, that velocity changes, becomes less and less of time, becomes zero at some point right here, which you define as the top of the motion, and then the velocity downward begins to grow. But those are sort of two independent problems, so the way to do this kind of complicated thing is to break it into single-dimensional problems, sort of solve each of those independently, tying them together as needed, in the sense that you may be asked, where does the ball hit the ground? Well, that involves knowing, one, how long it's in the air, and two, how far does it go within that same time? And it's the time that marries those two different solutions together and makes the problem work. So then, once you sort of solve each of these independently, you then tie them together. So lots of vector analysis, and I imagine this is boring the crap out of you because I gave you a bunch of homework problems on it, which I hope you figured it all out. So the other thing we did last time is we talked a little bit about Newton's law of gravitation, which I'm just giving to you, okay? And it's called Newton's universal law of gravitation. It basically states there's a force between two objects that have mass, whatever mass is, if one has M1, one has M2, they're separated by a distance r. The magnitude of the force goes as some constant, which sets the scale of the force, times mass 1 times mass 2, divided by the distance between them squared. I can write this as a vector equation, basically telling you the force is a vector. It has both a magnitude and a direction. I tell you that it is along this vector that joins the center. So it basically is along the direction between the masses. And I put in a minus sign right here, which basically defines it to be attractive, because r hat would be out this way, and if I ask what is the force of M1 on M2, it is in the opposite direction of r hat. So by putting this minus sign in, I'm defining this to be an attractive force. Okay, you're going to see something exactly like this in physics 114, except you're going to have a K here instead of a D. You're going to have a Q1 and a Q2, which will represent things we call electric charge, divided by R squared. It has the exact same form, and there are lots of similarities between gravitation and electricity because of that. There's one huge difference. Mass only comes as mass. It has one sign, which means when you algebraically calculate this, you will always get a negative sign, which means it is always an attractive force. We don't yet know about anti-gravity. But when you have electromagnetism, you have charges. Those charges can come with plus signs or minus signs. So that means if you have a plus plus, you end up with a minus sign, and you don't put in the minus sign, because the plus plus gives you a repulsive force. If you have a plus minus, you get the minus sign, and it's attractive. So that makes a big difference between gravitation and electromagnetism. The other difference being sort of the size of the constant. So for many of the problems you'll be doing in the early part of this course, you'll be doing problems near the surface of the Earth, because they're very intuitive, they're very relevant, and it's a good thing to do. So you can imagine that you're standing on the surface of the Earth, and let us ask, what is the force of the Earth on some object? If that's the case, then we basically take this magnitude equation, we put in the mass of the Earth for one of the masses, and I'm just going to tell you, although I'm not proving it to you, we can pretend that the entire mass of the Earth exists at one point, which is at the center of the Earth, to be the symmetry of the problem. Okay? Later in the course, we'll calculate things like center of mass, and this will sort of become more intuitive for you. But for now, it may sound sort of crazy, but we do that. So we put the mass of the Earth here, the mass of the object that's being tossed there, and we put the radius of the Earth here as the distance between the objects. And that means that this equation boils down to having one constant, because the mass of the Earth and radius of the Earth don't change, times m. And we call that constant, when you calculate it out, you end up with 9.8 meters per second squared. We call that g, and we call that the acceleration due to gravity, or the acceleration of a freely falling object near the surface of the Earth. I hate to say it, but the near the surface of the Earth is actually important. You have to say that, because otherwise it doesn't necessarily make any sense. Anyway, as we're about to find out, Newton tells us that F equals ma is sort of a defining thing about what a force is. So the force is equal to mass times the acceleration. So if you look at this and you look at this, you can see that at the surface of the Earth, F is equal to ma. Okay, so g plays the role of acceleration. So just get used to that. Notice I didn't put a minus sign in there. If I defined upward as positive, then yeah, I'd want a minus sign, or I'd put in a minus 9.8. You can define positive down. Just be consistent once you're doing a problem as to how there is no rule like g is always negative. The only rule is that the acceleration due to Earth is that way. Okay, and then everything else depends on how you're looking at the problem and how you define things. You okay with that?
Yeah.
Thank you. All right, now we're going to get into it, but let us talk for a moment about Sir Isaac, okay? I always thought he does look a little bit like an 80s big hair rock star, but maybe that's just me. Almost everything that we're going to learn about, certainly in a huge chunk of this term, comes from this guy. And there's a book that he published, now I'm forgetting what year it was, like 1684 or something like that. I can't remember that. Called Principia, we just call Principia. And in it, it lays down the basics of mechanics, which is what we're studying. And through the years, I mean, he invented calculus to do this. Right? I mean, that's sort of extreme if you think about it. But you've already seen the need to use calculus to go to the small time limit because things are changing. So in order to do these kinds of problems, you really do have to have the mathematics that works in the infinite limit. And so he invented calculus. He gave us the law of gravitation. Albert Einstein came up with a new theory that is dramatically more complex. It's also beautiful. It's based on geometry that supersedes Newton's law of gravitation, but only if you're trying to land a gnat on Mars or something. I mean, it's like Newton's gravity works for almost anything that you would ever want to do. He did a lot of work in optics. He's truly, truly an amazing guy. I had a fun time. I have a buddy who's on the faculty at Oxford, and I went to visit him once. We had too much scotch and broke into the Oxford Jesus College library. Well, we didn't break in, we had a key, but we probably weren't supposed to be up there handling the manuscripts. So this was totally a high point of the trip. Now, I'm not suggesting you do this after having scotch, but U of R has a world-class medical book library in minor library. They have an absolutely fabulous Connect collection. If you haven't seen it, find out sometime it's on display and go. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. You've got stuff pre-Vesalius, so, you know, it's really bizarre artistry, right? There's a lot of neat things in the pictures that you can see about how the medical classes went. And then you've got Vesalius and the post stuff where it starts to look like modern medical things, you know, where, you know, real diagrams try to be very accurate. And it's absolutely fabulous. And I don't know, if you haven't really gone and looked at some of these amazing pieces of work, they're real, and it's absolutely cool to see them. One of the cool things about, I mean, this book was not all that big. These medical texts are huge and beautiful, okay, and they've got all these just absolutely fabulous, even gilded pictures. I mean, it's really something, so go see it if you haven't had a chance. This guy Newton has laid the basics for modern physics as we know it. It really does include everything but electromagnetism and quantum mechanics and the mechanics of extreme velocities or density or masses. And that is a whole lot of stuff. You do need to throw this in because this is chemistry. But even chemistry has a lot of mechanics in it. So Newtonian physics is really a big deal. So anyway, we started our study really of this class in earnest and with what we call Newton's laws, okay? And there are three fundamental laws. There is one, Newton's first law, we call the law of inertia. And what it says is that a body persists in a state of motion unless acted on by an external net force. And I think actually in some ways that's counterintuitive. If I have a box and I push it, it moves. It stays in motion, okay? But if I stop pushing it, it stops. So our intuition maybe isn't so much that a body persists in its state of motion unless acted on by a force. But the issue there isn't that law is wrong. The issue is that there's a force there that you're not taking into account. It's the force of friction between this box and the surface. So if we go to a situation where you can remove the friction, then you find, in fact, motion will persist. So think of an ice skater, if you will, where you can remove friction. Another thing you can do, which we'll use here in some of this class, this is something that fits on this track very tightly, okay? I'm going to push very lightly here. It's not going anywhere. I'm not going to shove it because I don't want to scratch it. Okay? But if I push lightly, nothing happens. This is an air track, so you can think of it as just a funky-looking air hockey table, right? And you've done air hockey, so if you put a little bit of air to hold the object up above the floor, then you remove friction largely. And now, you touch that air hockey puck and it just goes. So the same thing is true here. I have air coming through lots of little holes here, and now if I move it, it just moves. Until acted on by a force, and it traverses its direction, okay? It's not completely frictionless, so eventually it slows down, but largely. Newton's law of inertia. You want to throw a rock in a sling if you're facing your Goliath, okay? When you do this, and you let go, that rock is going in a circle, okay? When you let go, that rock goes straight. And the reason it goes straight is because when it's moving in a circle, you have the string constantly pulling it in, causing its motion to change, okay? The moment you remove that force, its motion persists and it just goes straight. All right? So, the law of inertia. Newton's second law, that's the one that I've already mentioned a few times. Basically, it says the acceleration of an object is proportional to the net force applied to it and inversely proportional to the mass of the object. Or, the sum of the forces on an object is equal to the mass of the object times its acceleration. This is a vector equation, and it is a vector sum. So it doesn't matter that you have this force on an object or that force on an object. What's important is what is the net force on that object. And it will respond accordingly, okay? If that net force is large, you will get a large acceleration, but you will get a larger acceleration if the mass is small. If the mass is big, then a big force won't give you that big of acceleration. So for the law of inertia, think something like an ice skater. So for the law of the force law, maybe think about pushing a car on flat ground, right? You don't want to push a big car because you have to put so much effort into it to get it to move at all. But if it's a small car and you've got five helpers, you push it and it goes, right? So it will stop because you have friction, so it won't just keep going. And then we have one which actually will be the source of pain for many of you because it in a sense, it's almost a hidden force in some of the problems, and you have to look at the problem and understand it's there and take it into account. This is called the law of action and reaction. So for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Equal in magnitude and opposite in direction. So let's think about that. Some things I think are probably pretty obvious. If you've ever shot a gun, okay, if you've ever shot, imagine shooting a rifle, okay? When you shoot, what you have is an explosion that exerts a huge force on the bullet that's going out. That bullet exerts the same force on the gun going back, okay? The gun doesn't accelerate as much as the bullet because... what? Because it's more massive, right? Same force, but a much more massive thing, so it doesn't accelerate as much, so it doesn't necessarily rip your arm off, right? But you feel that force back at you. So when you push that bullet, it pushes you. If I do go out on the football field and I hit a big linebacker, surprisingly, I exert as much force on that linebacker as the linebacker does on me. But since my mass is small, I get the bigger acceleration. So that's why I don't do that stuff. Okay? But the force is the same. It can be a little bit weird. And you will do lots of string or rope problems or whatever. So you have that? Okay. So I'm going to pull. And when I pull, you feel it, right? I feel it pulling on me. To sort of make sense of that, okay, I do not want you to pull. I want you to just hold it. Alright? Okay. Seems like a good idea. Okay. Now, you do not pull. But I'm going to pull. And look what happens when I pull. I'm exerting a force on the rope. And the rope is exerting a force on me, which is why I move. Because I removed the friction. Okay? He's got lots of friction on his butt, so he's not sliding. Okay? Thanks. So it may seem a little bit weird, actually, if you would hold those. Sorry. You just picked the wrong seat. When I pull on this rope, okay, he feels it pulling on him, so there's a force vector on him. There's a force vector on me, okay? So this may seem really weird, but that rope is both pulling on him and me, and you wonder why it doesn't collapse. Well, if you think about the rope itself, it has a force on it going this way and a force on that side going that way. So a lot of this kind of business is simple if you look at it from the perspective of single pieces. It's complicated when you look at it as a net whole. Right? This is very confusing. It's pulling on me, it's pulling on him, what in the world's going on? But if you consider the rope itself, it's got two forces this way. It makes sense, it's stretching the rope. If you consider me by myself, it makes sense. There's a force on me this way. Right? If you think of him, there's a force on him this way. So the individual pieces to these problems sort of will make sense. But when you look at the whole thing together, it's really hard. So lesson number one we're going to find is you have to break the problem up into its little pieces and consider what's happening in each of the little pieces. And of course, they are all related. The force on me was exactly the same as the force on him, but it was equal and opposite in direction. It is part of the action-reaction pair that is part of the third law of Newton. Okay, I don't know. My aspect ratios are all screwy on this particular file. I guess I must have stolen a sheet from some other file that had a different aspect ratio, and now it's all screwed up. Anyway, I'm just going to live with it. So notice Newton's second law says the sum of the forces is equal to the mass times the acceleration. And note that that is a vector equation. That is a vector equation. Which means it is actually three different equations. It says that the net force in the X, the sum of the forces in the X is equal to M times A in X. The sum of the forces in the Y is equal to M times A in the Y. And the sum of the forces in the Z is equal to MA in the Z. All right? So this whole thing can be three-dimensional, so you're stuck with the whole vector world, and you're going to have to break things up along orthogonal directions in this sort of way, okay? X, Y, and Z might, in a problem where you're doing a projectile or something, it may be very obvious for you to choose. So X would be the horizontal direction, and Y would be the vertical direction. But suppose we're on an inclined plane, we're going to find that it makes sense to actually rotate the axes to go up and down the plane and in and out of the plane. Okay? orthogonal axes don't get hung up on x, y being vertical and horizontal, or other way around. Right? So you'll have to define the axes. For circular problems, in fact, the axes are going to rotate with the ball or whatever. You have one toward the center and one tangential to it. So get used to that. In this case, I'm just sort of illustrating it with the three common orthogonal directions by writing down x, y, and z. You okay? All right. Here is the path to enlightenment. How to do these problems. This will make more sense when we do an example problem, but I want to have sort of this rubric in place so that you can sort of go back to it and remind yourself. First of all, you want to look at the problem and sort of see things, how things are moving. What is your intuition as to what is probably happening? Then you want to actually look at the problem and take each relevant piece of the problem and look at each of those individually. And what I mean by that is we draw what I'm going to call a free body diagram. That is, you take that body out of the problem, make a separate drawing of it, and draw all the forces that are on it and give them symbols, okay, in appropriate directions. You do that with each of the objects, label them with their forces, choose a coordinate system for the motion of each of these individual objects. It may sound sort of silly. If it's a ball going up and down, the coordinate system is sort of obvious, okay? But suppose we have a mass and a mass with a rope passing over it fully. When this one goes down, that one goes up. Okay? So you don't want to define up as positive because that might be strange. What you want is when one of them goes, when you want, say, a motion like this to be positive and a motion like that to be negative. And note that that means for one of these masses, up is positive, and for the other mass, up is negative. So the pieces get all tied together in the problem. So you have to look and make sure you understand how you define the direction and what it means in each piece of this problem. Then you want to apply Newton's law, the second law, the sum of the forces, to each of these objects. Because it holds true for each one of them. Okay? And then this will now give you an equation in each dimension for each object. These equations are independent. Or maybe independent, depending on how the problem is all set up. And so now you'll get, if you get n equations and n unknowns, so two equations and two unknowns or whatever, you can now solve for that number of unknowns. So that's how the problem works. Yeah.
Do the axes for each other
can
be the same, or can
they be different for each? They'll be related. And we're going to do examples like this, but let me just give you an example. Suppose I have a box connected to a rope that goes around a pulley connected to a mass, like that. Now, it would make sense to choose maybe that's positive. You know, you won't have motion left and right on this, but you'll have this axis and that axis. But note what happens. When I go up and y with that mass, I go this way. So in fact, I would choose that positive, and so I would choose axes that are rotated. Okay? So there's a relationship between what's going on in each of these pieces. If that goes up, that goes down, and they would have the same velocity, right? If this goes up fast, that one goes down fast. So they're tied together in the problem, but the axes you choose are actually different. So there's a lot involved in choosing the right set of coordinates and everything. Okay, so you get these n equations and n unknowns, and then you algebraically solve them. And if you are uncomfortable with that, then you want to get comfortable with that very fast, because I'm not going to do a lot of that in here. I'm sort of expecting that that's something that you'll be bringing into this class from all your math classes through the years. So now you will solve for whatever it is you want to solve for, the tension in the rope, the acceleration of the mass, or whatever it is. So you'll have this expression, mathematical expression in terms of masses and g's and a's and whatever's in there, okay? You're not done. You're not even remotely done there. Well, you may be remotely done. You're close. I want you to always now look at that expression. And if it is asking for an acceleration, you look at all those symbols you have on there, and you look at the units, and you see that they equal meters per second squared, because you're looking for an acceleration, which means the units on one side better equal the units on the other. If they don't, you've screwed up. You don't need to ask me, a TA, or your book. You can check it. In addition, very often you can sort of look at that solution and know what's going on. So for example, suppose this is mass 1 and that's mass 2, and I solve for the motion of these guys, and I'll get some dependence on mass 1 and mass 2 and g and the tension, maybe the tension in the rope or whatever, okay? So I have an equation. Boy, suppose I look at that equation and I let mass 2 be really big compared to mass 1. I know exactly what's going to happen. If this is a huge mass, so much that this you can't even feel, this thing free falls straight down as an acceleration of g. So my mathematical expression better simplify to that in the limit of mass 2 is big. We call that limiting cases. So very often in the physical situation, you can actually dream of a limiting case or two that where the answer is just obvious. And so you look and make sure your mathematical expression simplifies to that. If it does, you know you're right. Okay? If you plugged in numbers, you can't do this. So if you have this gut instinct of immediately putting numbers in and solving for numbers as soon as you can, you want to break that. Because when you do these problems, you want to keep things in symbols insofar as you can. Because you want to be able to check units, unit analysis, and you want to be able to check limiting cases. It's extremely powerful. And it's very often, especially for problems in this class, that between those two things, you can actually know that you got the right answer without ever looking in the back of the book. When you're doing your problems on a test, for example, I'm very interested in how you set it up. I'm very interested in whether you can get the right equation and tell me that you've got the right equation. I don't give a crap if you can plug the numbers in and give me a number in the end, okay? If you screw that up, you'll lose 1 point or something because we have to have headroom for somebody who does it perfectly. But if you mess up how you're setting it up, that's where we whack you. Okay? Any questions? All right, so now I want to do an example. Just to sort of begin to get the hang of this. Just a word of caution. I want you to actually try to do this rubric. I have a philosophy about these types of problems. Even if you look at it and you think you have an intuition as to what's going to happen, it pays off if you are anal and systematic in doing these problems. I want you to really get in the habit of doing the free body diagrams neatly, because if you're not neat, you're actually going to confuse yourself at some point later on, because you weren't careful about drawing this force straight up. It looks like at an angle. You're going to halfway through this problem, and then you're going to start putting some angle in there, which isn't in the problem, and you'll be messed up. So you want to actually take your time, make decent drawings, and go through here and do the sum of the forces and whole thing. Even when you get pretty used to this stuff, because it is really easy to make simple little mistakes and be completely off with this stuff. So really, you want to just slow it down and be systematic about it. Okay, so let's look at an example. In this example, let me suppose that I have a helicopter. And that helicopter has a rope that's attached to it. a single rote, in spite of what it looks like. And that rope has just pulled somebody out of the clutches of, I don't know, Jaws, just down here, okay? So it's sort of an air-sea rescue problem. And in this problem, we're going to say that the man has a mass of 70 kilograms, and we're going to say that the helicopter accelerates upward at 4 meters per second squared. The question is, what tension must the rope withstand? What's tension in a rope? Tension's our word for sort of the force along the rope itself. If I have a huge tension, it means it's being pulled from both ends by a huge force. And it'll snap if it's too much. Okay? So any rope or string or whatever will have some sort of limiting tension where it'll snap. Okay, so that's the problem.
So how do we do it? Well, we go back and we look at the rubric and we say, let's draw a free body diagram for each piece. So here's our helicopter. All right, it's a nice block helicopter. What are the forces on the helicopter?
Gravity.
So we have something which is the mass of the helicopter times G. And I gave it a direction going down. What other forces?
Accelerated upward.
I asked for a force, not an acceleration, but there is something that has to be holding it up. So in this case, I'm going to say it's the force of the air on the rotors, okay? Yikes. What else?
Force of the rotor pulling down and attaching.
Yeah. Remember, what we're doing is we're breaking the problem up into its relevant pieces, and I'm looking at the helicopter. That's not the helicopter plus man. It's different. Which means the helicopter is a force on it, which is that of the rope pulling down.
Oh, actually, which is what we... The force that the rope is pulling down is the tension in the rope. So I'm going to give it a symbol T. Okay. Is there another object I should be diagramming? There's the man. So here's our man. The man has two forces on him. The force of gravity down, which is equal to the mass of the man, times G. And there's a force upward, which is T.
Is this related in any way to that? Those are two ends of the same rope. Newton's third law. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So if I pull on one end of the rope, the other end of the rope has the same force. So this is what ties things together, okay? That T and that T have the same symbol. So I have to give them... In doing that, I'm saying that they have the same magnitude.
Okay, I have to choose a coordinate system. Let's just choose it plus being up. We can call it y if you wish. It doesn't matter. Now, if you look at these two, It's not always the case that what you write makes any sense or can be used. I don't know anything about the force of the air on the rotor, other than somehow it's sufficient enough to give me an acceleration of 4 meters per second squared. I don't know anything about the mass of the helicopter. So my guess is that I'm not going to get much out of this, but except for the fact that I know this, what its acceleration is. But let me look at this side, and let's look at the sum of the forces in the y here. That's going to be equal to t, which is positive because it's going up, and I've defined up as positive for this man, minus the mass of the man times g. The minus sign signifies going down. Okay? What is that equal to?
Sum of the forces is always, always, always equal to the mass of that object times A. So once I sum these forces, it's equal to M, the M that I'm thinking about, not mass of the helicopter, but mass of the man, times the acceleration in the Y.
The acceleration you've been given, it's 4 meters per second. Well, the helicopter is going accelerating at 4 meters per second. If the rope doesn't snap, the man is accelerating at 4 meters per second. Because there's a trick about ropes in this class. They don't stretch. Okay? So, all problems. If you're starting to worry about that rope stretching, you need to be an engineer and not in a physics class. Okay? Because this isn't the real world. This is, we're definitely sort of making lots of approximations to sort of try to make some sense out of this crap. So, we know the mass of the man, we know G. Okay, so this is 70, this is 70, this is 9.8, and this is 4. Okay? This needs to be newtons. Forces are in newtons. Force is equal to ma, so this is newtons. A newton in terms of other variables must be equal to a kilogram meter per second squared because it's equal to ma. So if I look at the units of this equation, t minus m man g equal to m man a, this is in units of force, or newtons. This is kilograms, meters per second squared. So that's in newtons. This is kilograms, meters per second squared. So that's in newtons. So all three things have the same units, and that's a good thing. Okay? The tension is equal to the mass of the man times A plus G. So the rope has to withstand a tension that is equal to this. So let's see if it makes any sense. Clearly, if you're not accelerating upward, then the rope has to support MG. If A is zero, I have MG. Good. That's one limiting case that you should be able to figure out. If the helicopter is accelerating upward really fast, then the tension that it has to support gets really big. Why? What it means is the helicopter wants to accelerate really fast. It's got to yank that guy up with a big acceleration. How do you do that? By having a tremendous force accelerating it. So if you pull up really fast, you get a huge force on the rope, which means a big tension. Big A, big T. Okay? So you look at it, say, wow, it makes sense. You're done. Okay? And now you plug them. You end up, when I did this, was 966 newtons. But you can see it's sort of irrelevant. Any questions on this? All right. Pull out your clickers. Let's do a clicker problem. Go ahead and connect using the number one. It'd be really great if we could have more than 42 people bringing their clickers. That's starting to be pretty low in statistics. Okay, so let us imagine that we have two massive balls hanging from the ceiling, okay, or hanging from something. And there's a string here and a string here. And a string here, and a string here, okay? And now, we come up, and we go to this left-hand one, and we slowly pull on that string, and pull on the string, and pull on the string, and pull on the string first. On the right-hand one, we grab it at the bottom, and yank. And when we yank, a string breaks, okay? So my question for you is, given this scenario, of which I have drawn it up four times here, I'm going to call this one scenario A, scenario B, scenario C, scenario D. So let's say for scenario A, this string breaks here, this string breaks here. Scenario B, this string breaks here, this string breaks here. Scenario C, this string breaks here, this string breaks here. In scenario D, this string breaks here, this string breaks here.
All four possibilities, okay? What I'd like you to do is to look at this for a moment and decide which of these cases you think is what would happen in reality if we were to do it. Fix in your mind which letter corresponds to which case that you believe would happen.
And now, vote.
All right, so most people think B, So 23, 13, 12, and 5, BC, AD.
BC.
All right, so that's what you think. Okay? So let's see what happens. So I was saying slow on your left. Okay? Everybody saying that? Come on. Untied, okay. Top under. Bottom. Bottom under. Tell me why. What do you think? Okay, so what he's saying is it has to do with the law of inertia. If I apply the force very quickly, this ball is reluctant to start really moving in a sense, so it doesn't really convey the full force up to this. Let me start with the other one, actually. I pull it very slowly. As I increase the tension here, I am also increasing the tension here. This one only needs to withstand the tension that my fingers are giving me. This one must withstand that tension plus the mass of the weight of the ball. So, as you slowly pull this, the tension in this one is always greater than the tension in that one. So if the strings are identical, in this case, you'll break here. Okay? If you yank it, okay, I have a big tension, and F equals MA, but this is a big mass, so A is pretty small. So I have very unequal tensions here for that slip moment, right? And this one's going to be bigger because this ball has yet to start accelerating to stretch this and give it tension. Okay? I'm pretty sure I've written that down as an exam problem before. This is what happens explained. Or tell me what happens and explain. Or whatever. Okay? And it's sort of subtle. Right? When you think about it by looking at these individual things and try to think about what's happening. So while I'm up here, I got a couple of others. Let's see. We said the body in motion remains in... Oh, so we noticed that the force of gravity, G, acceleration due to gravity, does not depend on the mass. Because the force depends on M, the force is mg. So the force depends on the mass, but the acceleration does not. Okay? And that's actually a little bit weird. What I have here is a tube with a penny and a feather. And the penny's down at the bottom, the feather's not accelerating very fast. Okay? Why? Because the feather's big and feathery, and there's a lot of air friction sort of holding it up. There's an additional force. But look what happens. So your intuition often sort of gets built that way. You know, you sort of think of it that way. Now what I want to do is to evacuate the tube. City gang needs that. I didn't let it evacuate quite enough. But you can see it's going a lot faster. If you put it in a perfect vacuum, the feather goes as fast as the pin. Alright? So, there's that. Ta-da! Okay. I need some big guy in here to come up. Somebody that doesn't like physics. Come on! This is a chance of a lifetime, trust me. There are a bunch of big wusses. Alright, we got one who's not a wuss. Yay! And you are?
Jared.
Jared? Alright, Jared. I want you to stand right here. Now, you have a hammer? I have here the lead brick. Okay? I'm going to put the lead brick on my hand. I'm going to put my hand right here. And I want you to take the hammer and hit that brick. Hard. But I warn you, if you miss the brick and you hit my fingers directly, I will do everything in my power to make sure you never graduate from me. Alright? So, go for it. Alright. I guess he is a wuss. Thanks, Jared. I bet you can't. All right, I don't feel a thing. You want to do it? All right, put your hand on. Okay. All right, you ready? You feel anything? All right, I want you to wash your hands really well. Don't pick your nose and don't step on your fingers for the rest of this class, because this is lead, and lead is not good to ingest. In fact, we should have that thing wrapped up, so I'm sorry about that.
What's a little bit of heavy metal among friends?
Why would I do that? Who in their right mind would have a student come up and hit their hand on the hand? And I was serious that I didn't want to miss the brick of what's going on. Okay. F equals ma. I hit it with the hammer. I have a pretty big F, but that is one honking mass. So it just doesn't get much of an A, and in the end, it has to effectively have an acceleration. I mean, it's gotta move in order to squash my hand. Alright? If I remove the brick, or I put a little block of wood there, we have a different story. Okay? So that's the law of inertia. Alright, I need... anybody here involved in, like, I don't know, EMT stuff? I need your help. I need you on call here. Ah, good. You are?
Hannah.
Okay, and we met, but...
Suge.
Okay, Hannah and Suge. Anybody appointment? Band-aid. You good?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Tell the class what you see in this.
Broken glass.
What?
Broken glass.
All right. that. Become somebody else. What do you think?
So unless the connecting part of the glass is positioned in such a way so that it cannot move up against your foot, the force of the foot going down is going to flatten it. So the flat part of the glass, which isn't going to touch you, is most likely to hit the skin of your foot.
Maybe. You want to try it?
Okay.
All right. So she said that basically the points can move. But I would pour this out on the floor and do that too. I just don't want to clean up the mess. Okay, so somebody else up front says the weight is distributed. So it's sort of Newton's second and third laws. Okay? So here's my wonderful foot. And what I have is the force of gravity on my body pulling down, right? In order for me not to go crashing through the floor, there has to be force, a net force of that magnitude up. We call that the normal force, okay? Because that's what is holding and keeps you from crashing through the floor. It's not saying that that entire force is all at one point. I have lots of pieces of glass. So each point is supporting a fraction of my weight. Okay? Now, when I did this, smashed the glass, there's a story there, I did go through and pick out the huge pieces of glass that were sticking way up, because I would not do this if I were landing on one piece of glass. Okay? Because then all of my weight's there, and then the force is sufficient to go into my foot. But if you got lots of pieces there, you can lie on a bed of nails or something, right? If you're supported in a lot of places, each one is okay. But you're not going to lie on one nail. Okay? That's not cool. All right. So some of you probably know my son David. I think when I was doing this the first time, he was probably 8 or something. And so I went out into the garage and I emptied like a couple of cases of beer bottles into bags, triple bagged them, and then went out to the driveway and threw the bag right there. And I was so intent on what I was doing. And after I did this 2 or 3 times to try to get the pieces small enough, David, the old guy, comes walking and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm smashing beer bottles." And you know, the 7 or 8-year-old boy was like, "Good, can I do it?" So it was really fun. So I have to say that if you want to be at least a temporary hero to your son someday, just go get the beer bottles and put them in the bag and smash them on the driveway. That thing is absolutely cool. Anyway, that was fun. So that's how I got the glass. I then had to spend a little while to pick out the pieces that were too big and sticking straight up. So there we go. So much for self-immolation day. Let's do a different problem. Yes. Imagine that I have what's called a massless and frictionless pulley. So you'll be seeing a lot of those, and massless and frictionless are important caveats. It's just a wheel that we will think of as having no mass, because if it has mass, it actually takes the force to turn it, and we will do that, but it will be later in the class. So for now, assume that the wheel has no mass, and it's frictionless, so you lose nothing in time to turn. And basically, you can now put a rope or a string across it, and all it does is change the direction of the tension. So we have a massless and frictionless pulley, and let's say that we have a rope that goes across this pulley, and it hits, it's attached to the rope. We have M1 and M2, so two different masses. They could be the same in terms of magnitude or not, I don't know. This thing goes by a name, if you see it in the book or whatever. It's sometimes called an Atwood's machine, which is just basically irrelevant, but if you see it in the book, that's what it means. Let me assume that M1 is equal to 6 kilograms, and M2 is equal to 10 kilograms, and the system is at rest. System at rest is released. What is the acceleration of the system? All right, that's sort of just a way of saying what is the acceleration of one mass going up and the other mass going down. Right, and those accelerations have to be the same. If one's going down, the other's going up, because the rope doesn't break and it's not stretched. Or it goes this way. If this one moves up an inch, that one goes down an inch. So the accelerations are the same. Okay? So we talked about the acceleration of the system. You could find the acceleration of one of the masses, and you know that then is the acceleration of the system. Alright, so I want to look at free body diagrams. I want to define coordinate system. And a natural thing that you might think to do is to define the coordinate system where y points up, and then you do each of the free body diagrams. So this is an example where you might define up to be positive for M1, and that's fine, but when this one's going up, that one's going down. So it really makes sense to define it in terms of motion like that versus that. And so I want to define motion like that as positive, which means when that one's going up, it's positive. When this one's going down, it's positive. All right, and then I want to do free body diagrams. For the pulleys, it's just being held on the wall or something. So you really, it's irrelevant. It is true that I have a tension down on it and a tension down on that, and I have to have something holding it up. But it's a little bit like the helicopter in the last problem. They're sort of ill-defined stuff, and so unless I ask you specifically what is the force on this pulley, you don't really need to worry about pulleys so much. So the relevant pieces of this problem are this mass and that mass, and you want to draw free body diagrams for those separately. We're going to choose a coordinate system where motion like this is positive, which means positive up here, positive down over here. And we're going to define everything with respect to that. So within that coordinate system, if we look at the free body diagram for mass 1, it has a tension up, which is the tension in the rope. It has M1G down. On the right-hand side for M2, we have a tension that's going up and M2G that's going down. I now want to sum the forces. I don't need to worry about the horizontal direction, but I need to worry about the vertical direction. The sum of the forces in the Y, we've now defined Y positive on this left-hand one. So this is equal to MA, where M is the mass of that object. So this is mass 1 times the acceleration of that object. That's equal to T, which is positive because it's going up in the direction I've defined as positive for that mass, minus M1G. On the other side, the sum of the forces in the Y
equal to m2 times a, because it's the acceleration of that mass, because I'm considering that free body diagram. And that is equal to the sum of the forces, and now I have to be consistent with my signs or I screw it up. In this case, if the left-hand one is going up is positive, the right-hand one going down is positive, so I have to have that coordinate system. So now m2a is going to be equal to minus t plus m2g. The most common place where people will blow this type of thing is right there. If you put the wrong sign in, you're done for. Okay? Now you have two equations. I know G, I know M2, I know G, I know M1. I don't know the acceleration, I don't know the tension. I don't know the acceleration, I don't know the tension. I have two equations, and I have two unknowns. So it's now a soluble algebraic problem. If you find that you have too few equations for the unknowns you have, you need to think about the problem a little harder. Okay? It may be that you have completely omitted something, and maybe there's a source of equations that you haven't thought of yet, but it's an indication you have a problem. Okay, so I don't want to go through the algebra because I'm out of time, but I'll put in the notes the algebra. But let's say that when we do the algebra, what you find is that the acceleration is equal to m2 minus m1 over m1 plus m2 times g, and the tension is equal to m2 times g minus m2g minus m1g over m1 plus m2. And sorry, I started to do a little bit of algebra. So the tension ends up being 2gm1m2 over m1 plus m2. Okay, I want to look at these for a moment. On the left-hand side, you have an acceleration, meters per second squared. On the right-hand side, this is an acceleration, meters per second squared. This is in kilograms, that's in kilograms, the total units here are zero, so the units agree. Does it make any sense? Suppose M2 is really, really big, that is, the right-hand side is really, really big, okay? Then you know the acceleration is going to go like that. That means it's going to be positive given how we've defined it, and that's a good thing. If M1 is really, really big, it's going to go the other way, and then you have a negative acceleration. In terms of tension, you might want to pull out L'Hopital's rule to sort of look in the limit. Do you remember L'Hopital? You've done that in calculus, I assume. Basically, in the limit of, say, M1 getting really big, you sort of have an infinity over an infinity. So you take the derivative up here and the derivative there, and you look at the limit there, and that will give you an idea of what's going on. So, but anyway, also this is kilograms squared, this is kilograms, so this is kilograms meters per second squared, so the units are right. All right, so I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Go lab. And I'll be in touch with you next week. So email me if you have questions. If you haven't given me your homework, you owe me one up here.